Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Baseball in the 1930s was more than a national pastime. It was a cultural touchstone that galvanized communities and gave a struggling country its heroes, despite the woes of the Depression. Hank Greenberg, one of the most exciting sluggers in baseball history, gave the people of Detroit a reason to be proud. But America was facing more than economic hardship. With the Nazis gaining power across Europe, political and social tensions were approaching a boiling point. As one of the few Jewish athletes competing nationally, Greenberg became not only an iconic ballplayer, but also an important and sometimes controversial symbol of Jewish identity and the American immigrant experience. The new book, Hank Greenberg, by John Rosengren, offers an intimate account of the man's life on and off the field. Rosengren is an award-winning author whose other books include Hammer and Hank, George Almighty, and the Say Hey Kid, The Year That Changed Baseball Forever. John Rosengren, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, good morning, Joe. Pleasure is mine.
It is a delight. You have certainly taken a look at many incredible names within the sport of baseball and written about these figures. What drew you to Hank Greenberg?
You know, Hank was a great ball player, Hall of Fame player, but what set him apart, or I think distinguishes him, is his significance to society beyond baseball. So, he transformed the way Gentiles viewed Jews, and in turn the way Jews viewed themselves. And during a time of intense turmoil in the United States, as well as abroad, he became a beacon of hope for people. And that story, I thought, needed to be told, and there was not a definitive biography out, and I thought, well, there's a chance for me to write it.
In looking at, with that in mind, of the definitive biography, what do you think were the missing chapters in the story of Hank Greenberg?
Well, there weren't so many missing chapters as there were just some misconceptions and erroneous details. The big book that was out there was an autobiography where Greenberg had spoken into a tape recorder the summer he was dying, and he'd recorded his memories, and Ira Burko took the 600 pages of that transcript and then tried to make a book out of it, and he filled in the gaps. But the result is that it's a kind of choppy narrative, and because Greenberg was speaking or trying to recall things from 40, 50 years earlier, his memory wasn't always accurate. So that book was just, as I set out on my research, there were some errors in it, and I wanted to correct those. Also, as I did do my research, I uncovered new details about Greenberg, from the fact that he was a dog lover, kind of against his own wishes. His wife had brought in a dog to foster, and he was reluctant. He fell so in love with the dog that she said one of the only two times she saw him cry in his life was when that dog died. To the fact that he'd worked for the Ford Motor Company, basically as a spy, which was rather startling because it was common for Ford to hire athletes to be meeters and greeters, you know, shake hands and do PR. But Greenberg worked for Harry Bennett, the security guy, and on his military records, Greenberg listed his job description as investigating people who were suspicious to the company, which could have meant the owner of the Tigers, his boss, Walter Briggs, who'd had a falling out with Harry Bennett. So these sorts of details I found added a little extra texture and flavor to the Greenberg story.
One of the things I found fascinating about him was you talk in the book about he had the size and he had the strength, but he wasn't a natural when it came to agility. He worked really hard at this.
Exactly. He was blessed with size, not agility. His became this Horatio Alger story of success. As a young boy, he took extra batting practice in the park across the street, Cortona Park, where he grew up in the Bronx, and he had kids pitch to him, and he played until he had blisters on his hands. He continued that work ethic into the major leagues, where he'd show up to the park an hour or 2 hours early and pay guys to pitch to him, pay kids to shag balls, and the results were, 313 lifetime batting average and enshrinement in the Hall of Fame.
A kid from the Bronx, and he gets the attention of the Yankees, but that doesn't work out. What is it about that situation that he's wary of?
well, you'd think it'd be a natural to have this kid from the Bronx play for the home team, right? But and the Yankees were pursuing him, and the scout Paul Critchell took Hank to a game, and Greenberg, sitting in the front row by the Yankee dugout, saw this mountain of a man climb out of the dugout and start swinging bats. Well, Babe Ruth was at the plate. It wasn't Ruth who captured his attention. It was Lou Gehrig in the on-deck circle. Greenberg took one look at the first baseman's broad shoulders and thick chest and thought, there's no way I'm going to displace this guy in first base. And Critchell tried to convince him that Gehrig was washed up, but of course we know that it would be 9 years before anybody else started at first base for the Yankees. So Greenberg wisely decided to sign with the Tigers instead.
So he begins in the minors. He has a really strong season, his rookie season in 1933, and then the next year he's doing great at with the Tigers.
Right, and 34 is the year that many people remember from Greenberg's career, because that was the year that the Tigers were in a pennant race, had their chance to win their first pennant in 25 years. Detroit had been thrust into the throes of the Depression. Factories were closing. Soup lines were stretching around the corners. So the Tigers and baseball provided a diversion and something for Detroit to feel good about. But the High Holy Days were coming up in September, and Greenberg had promised his parents he wouldn't play. They were Orthodox Jews. He'd been raised in an Orthodox household, bar mitzvah himself. So, and he promised him he wouldn't play on those days. At the same time, he felt this civic duty to play for the city, and also he didn't want to let down his teammates, because at the time he was the only one really going strong. The team had slumped a bit, and Greenberg was still hitting well. Well, after agonizing over the decision, he finally decides to play on Rosh Hashanah. He hits two home runs, wins the game for the team, 2-1. And then 10 days later, with the pennant pretty much clinched, he decides to sit. And that personal decision for him became very public. At the time, baseball is the national pastime and gets more attention than any other sport. And so Greenberg rose to this natural stature. And many people really respected him for kind of making a compromise and actually becoming a role model for other children of immigrants looking to assimilate, because he was able to perform and work on one day and rest on another. And that solidified his stature as a national hero.
He was drafted into the Army by 1941, really at a time when he's the biggest star in the game.
You're right. In the spring of 41, he was the reigning MVP. He was the highest paid ball player of the game. Williams hadn't hit 400 yet. Joe DiMaggio was yet to hit in 56 straight games. And so Greenberg was the most prominent athlete in America. His draft induction attracted a lot of attention. He recognized that he could only earn money at playing baseball while he was good at it, and he was in his prime, and he wanted to be able to finish the 41 season before going into the service. Of course, America wasn't into the war yet, and baseball itself, Major League Baseball, wanted to keep its players around as long as it could. But that touched off a national controversy with the debate raging between someone pursuing the American dream to do well in the land of capitalism versus civic duty to serve one's country and express one's patriotism. Ultimately, Greenberg went in, served 8 months. Congress passed a law that men over 30 didn't have to serve any longer, so he was honorably discharged on December 5, 1941, eager to return to baseball. Well, 2 days later, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. Greenberg was the first major leaguer to reenlist. And the fact that he figured the war would last a while, and at the time, believed that meant he would have to give up his career, but he believed it was worth the cause, and his willingness to sacrifice his career for his patriotism elevated him to that hero of heroes status in America.
So he served 47 months in the military, and then he returns to the majors in 1945, and of course the big question in everybody's mind is how are any of these players going to fare after their military service? And it took one game to sort of show what he had, right?
Right. After the war, and this is midsummer 45, Europe has surrendered, but not the war is still going on in the Pacific. But Americans are aching for this return to normalcy, and they've suffered through not only the sacrifices of war with rationing and all that, but also subpar level baseball. And they're looking to baseball to restore the sense of normalcy to the country. Well, Greenberg's the first star to come back. He's been out over 4 years. He hasn't played much at all. He played 3 exhibition games and less than a handful of softball games in his over 4 years in the military. So players are looking at him to see if they can, if somebody can make it come back. Fans are looking at him to see if the Stars will be able to perform again. First game back, he hits a home run. Everyone rejoices. He carries that on through the season. He's hampered by some nagging injuries like twisted ankle and sore hamstrings. But on the final day of the 45 season, he hits a ninth-inning grand slam to clinch the pennant for the Tigers and ultimately leads them to the victory in the World Series, capping the most amazing comeback in the annals of sport.
It's an amazing
and one that carried extra significance for the nation, feeling with relief that, yes, life will go on as before.
It's an amazing story. I mean, absolutely incredible. Now, obviously, we talked about his dealing with the High Holy Days and dealing with not only his religion but his sport and his community and how he represented his team. But this was not all a bed of roses. He certainly had his share of anti-Semitic threats. He certainly had his share of controversy over that, and it's interesting to me of how not only do you just go about and be a good player, but then you have to deal with that on top of it.
Right, and we need to remember that these times were different. In the 30s and 40s, anti-Semitism in the United States was as commonly practiced and accepted as Jim Crow laws.
Right.
And so he had to face the invectives not only from opposing fans, but also from fans in Detroit, which is where Henry Ford, the arch anti-Semite in America, had been writing his screeds against the Jews in the 20s, where Reverend Charles Coughlin, a Roman Catholic priest with a radio show of 10 million listeners, would spew his rhetoric that sounded like it had been written by Hitler's goons. So this is the environment, the hostile environment Greenberg played in, and the bench jockeying at the time was a lot different. The opponents would use anything they could to try to get under the skin of other players, including a lot of ethnic and insults. And he even faced it for his own team, calling him slurs. So he ended up standing up to that. He fought his own teammate at one point. He challenged the Chicago White Sox at one point when someone had called him a yellow Jew bastard. He went into the clubhouse after the game. He says, "I want to know who called me that." And he looked around, and Ted Williams used to love to tell the story. He said, "And you know who stood up? Nobody."
And when he retired and he moved into the front office, and he's still very much a part of baseball, and one of his legacies in that regard is fighting so hard to integrate baseball and welcome African Americans into the sport.
Right. He had compassion. He knew what it was like to suffer from the slings and arrows of abuse. And his teammate Bertie Tebbutt said, other than Jackie Robinson, no player stood more abuse than Hank Greenberg. And so when he found out, as general manager of the Indians, that the teams were staying in integrated in segregated hotels, and the African American players had to go elsewhere to find lodging, he stopped that. Made sure that all the hotels where the team stayed were integrated. He, along with Bill Veeck, the co-owner of the White Sox, was eager to sign African Americans, give them a chance to play. He was one of the few in organized baseball to testify on behalf of Curt Flood. So he was a humanitarian and did what he could to further the rights of all players.
The new book it's a fantastic biography. It's Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. It's by John Rosengren, and it's published by NAL. John, thanks so much for sharing with us this morning. I appreciate it, and congratulations on a great biography.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you, Joe. My pleasure.
A great pleasure indeed. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.